Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us today are two august members of the Defense and Aerospace Report team, our contributing editor, Christopher P. Cavas, one of the world's leading naval writers and experts who recently wrote a great commentary on our site, A Problem of Commitment, and our very own producer, Chris Cervello, a retired United States Navy commander, who is also the co-founder of the Provision Advisors PR firm. Chris and Chris, thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here, Vago.
Thanks for having us, Vago.
An absolute pleasure, gentlemen. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. General Motors Defense sponsors our coverage of technology. And Rafael Advanced Defense Systems sponsors our air and missile defense coverage. Cavas, thanks very much for joining us. You wrote an interesting tweet that got a lot of traffic. I want to get to that in a minute and get your views on the budget. But first, talk to us about A Problem of Commitment. It was a thought-provoking commentary. In one sense, it's about a narrow topic, but in a sense, you were actually writing about a bigger problem. Give the audience a sense of your argument, because on the face of it, it's about patrol craft, but it's actually a lot deeper.
Right. So from time to time, these needs come up for smaller ships. The Navy, everybody thinks of the Navy, and we think about great big ships that cross oceans and cover worldwide operations and conduct aircraft carrier warfare and anti-submarine warfare and have Aegis systems and, you know, destroyers that cost close to $2 billion, cruisers that cost more, aircraft carrier submarines that cost in the billions. So the Navy has no problem being committed to big, big, big things. Where they really fall down is in the lower end of the scale. And I think people don't always appreciate how busy and how active smaller craft can be. Smaller craft meaning patrol boats, minesweeping type ships, even the littoral combat ship, which is much smaller than the destroyers we have in service now. And there have been a series of programs going back decades where there was an urgent need for something, a particular kind of boat was developed, put into service, but the ships don't have a real constituency. People didn't grow up in them. And after a couple, you know, generations pass in terms of leadership, somebody else always comes in and says, you know, I'd rather spend the money elsewhere. So they dump them, and they've dumped them with a vengeance in some cases. So right now we have a situation where, ironically, some of these ships that were supposed to be dumped, the Patrol Coastal PCs, which were a 1990s craft, 10 of them have been very, very busy out in the Persian Gulf, where they're assigned a Fifth Fleet on patrol duties. And not what they were bought for, but what they evolved into. They've been very, very useful. They are wearing out. They need a replacement. So it's about some years ago, Fifth Fleet, which is the command out there, put an urgent need in for a replacement craft, asking for something small and very maneuverable and very heavily armed and interconnected with all the command and control facilities out there to do two things primarily. One is protect big ships that go in and out of choke points like the Strait of Hormuz. So you need something small and zippy and heavily armed to be able to counter those craft. And that's exactly what these Mark VI patrol boats were designed to do. The plan had been to buy 48 of these small boats, but the Navy has only put a handful of them out there. They stopped the buy at 12. There's only three operating out there. They are very busy. And now they're saying, oh, we don't want, you know, we don't want to spend the money on these things. We want to put our money elsewhere. By the way, they require too much maintenance. We're really excited about this new light amphibious warfare vessel, which is something that's coming out of the new marine operating concepts.
And that's the case, right? I mean, the new skinny budget says, right, trade-offs will be necessary. And so the Navy is saying, well, you know, we want to buy light amphibious warships. So as a consequence, we have to make tough choices. Right. This is the choice we've decided to make, or one of the choices we've decided to make.
The whole program collectively, with buying the boats, with setting up the training program, with support systems, runs around 125-150 million total, and it's all paid for. The price for the law right now, they haven't awarded contracts yet, but their RFP's out, and that's supposed to be up to 150 million. So for one law, you could buy all of the PC, all of the Mark Sixes. And I didn't mention the PCs are retiring. This was the replacement.
Right.
So,
and those are the, and when you say that, those are the larger Cyclone class ships, right? Of which the Navy has what, 10 now? One, well, the Philippines has one, I think, right?
It's a tortured history. It is a tortured history, and it's ironic that they wound up being, the Navy tried to get rid of them several times, and ironically they wound up being very useful and exactly what the service wanted despite itself. Right. So they really found a mission out in the Persian Gulf. They're very busy, they're very active, they're very useful, and they're wearing out. And this was the replacement. So without this replacement, the capability is not there. The Navy says they're going to make it up with littoral combat ships, which is another ship that they've never supported, was supposed to have been based out in the Gulf starting about 5 or 6 years ago. No littoral combat ship has even sniffed the Persian Gulf, and they're not going there anytime soon. And in any case, they're not escort ships, were never intended to be escort ships. That's not what that boat is by any means at all. That's hallucinogenic to describe it as such, but that's been an official description. So they're throwing these boats away halfway through, not even halfway, a quarter way through what was an urgent need acquisition program. And it's a clear need for something of which there's no clear need. The law, it fits into nobody's conops. It's not a craft that anybody recognizes as something we need or is traditional. It is, in other words, the next shiny object. And just as they have been infatuated with these programs, the Mark VI patrol boat, before that, the PCs for a while, before that, these hydrofoil missile boats, before that, gunboats, the LCS definitely falls into that. And you can even throw in the minesweeping force that the Navy has these moments of excitement and interest, and it soon passes and they don't support it. And they throw it all away. The investment is wasted. It's not rolled into anything else. And then something new comes along and they get all excited about it. And that's exactly what's happening now with this law. And if you listen to all the language that everybody enthusiastically talks about, this light amphibious warfare ship, it's going to be great. We'll be able to do this. It's going to be great opportunities for young commanders, all this stuff. Well, people were just as excited about all these other craft that came before it, and talked in even probably more glowing terms about how great they were going to be. There's no reason at all to think that the Navy as a culture, as an organization, is going to support the law, the light amphibious warfare ship. They don't, just like they're not supporting this. There's not even a need for the law, and there is a clear need for these relatively inexpensive, effective operational ships.
Chris Cervello, let me get your sense a little bit on this as well. Your brother commanded a PC. If I recall, it was the Squall over in the Gulf as well. How important a capability is this? And more broadly, is this the sort of, as Chris is sort of indicating, that this is sort of part and parcel, the Navy's lack of clear thinking about what it needs, what its priorities are, and how to best use its resources? Because this is an issue that regularly comes up, and it's not just an ad hominem criticism, but it's also a concern of the navalist and naval strategist community.
I think you both are right. It is the Navy's approach to small vessels has demonstrated a lack of commitment, a lack of understanding of the culture in the surface community, and really a lack of the ability to put together a constituency for these small boats, both on the Hill, within industry, and then within the joint and naval communities. They are wonderful opportunities for junior officers, for lieutenants and lieutenant commanders, the 03, 04 level, to command at sea, to build an understanding of what it takes to operate and command at sea at that level. They are wonderful platforms in terms of the flexibility that they offer fleet commanders and task force commanders in their ability to be moved around pretty quickly, and the flexibility that they provide. They just have not, as Chris mentioned, and as you alluded to, they just have not been given the budgetary priority that would be needed for you to not only grow and sustain that capability over time, to kind of overcome the lack of commitment, lack of culture, and lack of consistency. But they're an easy cut when it comes to prioritizing either the new and shiny or the legacy and long lasting. So until that changes, we're going to see this play out over and over again, I fear.
Chris Cavas, let's talk a little bit about the budget. It's going to be coming out. We have a skinny number, but from the standpoint of the Navy, it's encouraging, right? Because it talks about shipbuilding as the number three priority, right? Deterring China being the number one. You know, should that be interpreted as an encouraging? So, does it encourage you at all at the end of the day, or are you, what's your sense?
Show me the money. That's it. I mean, talk is cheap. Show me the money. Let's see what they're talking about. They mentioned, they say shipbuilding is important. That's nice. They talk about submarines. Submarines are the absolute guarantee that they're going to support. That doesn't need any particular advocacy. It's already in. They talk about unmanned. No, that needs tons of advocacy. And the buy-in on unmanned is not at all remotely there yet. So whatever, that's great rhetoric. So, but, you know, show us what money, show us the plan. Show us what's behind it. The Navy just put out an unmanned plan that the unmanned surface and undersea warfare plan that got very little respect. Most people just thought it was pretty pictures and not much content.
Well, you joined us to discuss it as well, and you were not terribly enthusiastic.
Nobody is. I haven't found out, haven't heard anybody on any side. He was terribly enthusiastic about it. So this is, you know, once again, show me the money. This is early days. We'll wait and see what comes out in the budget itself. But, you know, what kind of money will actually be in there?
Cervello?
Yeah, I mean, there is not currently a maritime plan, a maritime strategy, pick your favorite word, that this budget and the Navy's plans kind of fit nicely underneath. Saying shipbuilding is great, but I think shipbuilding at the OMB level, at the White House level, doesn't mean the same to folks at the naval level, right? Submarines are important, we need them, but we also need a strong surface conventional deterrent force in the future. And the two have been and will continue to be at odds at the current funding levels. That's number one. Number two, the Navy doesn't know how it wants to deter and fight China. And until the Navy figures that out, more submarines, more unmanned is going to be problematic, to say nothing of what we just talked about with a lack of commitment on smaller and newer vessels. So until you figure out how all of this fits nicely together, I really worry that it's spending good money after bad, and then the service gets things that it really doesn't know how to employ, both in the short and long term, driving to the same sort of lack of commitment that Chris talks about in his article.
Cervello, let me ask you a follow-up question, and I don't want to be disrespectful at all to the CNO Admiral Mike Gilday, but he's been making the case that the Navy's got a good plan. Is it problematic for the CNO, and I understand he's being impartial about it, but to continually keep referring to the plan, what some people would consider not a particularly well-reasoned plan from the last administration, or maybe a little bit too optimistic a plan from the last administration, as sort of the template and the model for whatever is going to come in this administration. It could be, but it also could be materially different. And it appears internally that that plan is maybe not at the core of what's going to happen. I mean, what's your sense on that?
Yeah, my sense is that they do not have a good plan. Now, let's assume that the CNO knows more than I do, which is a pretty good assumption. Then he needs to be out there communicating it. And I think that that's the concern, right? The assumption is based on things that we've seen over the last decade and a half is that the service, lots of good intention, very little in terms of solid plan, very little in terms of execution. And so when you do not do an adequate job of communicating the need, how you're addressing that need and the plans that you're making, you leave decision makers up on the Hill and on the third deck at DOD, you leave them with a lot of questions, and then you have a push and pull that is not in synchronous. And so until that happens, until everybody is pulling in the right direction, and I really believe that the impetus for that pull is going to be the CNO articulating what his plan is and where the Navy wants to go. Until that happens, I think you're going to have a lot of problems and a lot of wasted time and money. And we've had guest after guest after guest on this show that have said, we don't have the time and money to waste.
Kavis, I mean, what do you think about that plan, and how much of it do you think is going to succeed? And do you think the Navy does have a messaging problem here?
Of course they have a messaging problem. They don't know what they want to do. And that's become a theme. And you're hearing it in the oversight committees on the Hill. What is your point? What is your mission? Why do we have a Navy? And they are flailing at coming up with a good reason for that. They wave the flag and say it's great, it's important, but they don't put any meat behind that. And they need to do that sort of thing. Actually, ironically, the situation in the Suez Canal a few weeks ago is an interesting opportunity that they're not taking advantage of. They haven't jumped on that one. That's a really good example of how the world depends on maritime trade and how interconnected things are. And both in terms of that one particular ship, which is an enormous ship, much bigger than an aircraft carrier, 20,000 containers on that ship, full containers, not to mention the hundreds and hundreds of ships unable to transit through Suez that were bottled up for over a week. And there's a ripple effect right now all over the world in terms of prices that people are paying for goods. And that was just one incident. It's not by any means a wake-up call to navalists who are painfully aware of these possibilities, but the general public is not. And that would have been, that remains an excellent opportunity to say, you know, it's important that we maintain free and open trade and international trade. And we've used that as a theme, but it doesn't mean much to people. In this case, you have an opportunity to show where it does mean something. And they apparently haven't even noticed. Some people have noticed, commentators, but the Navy is not jumping on it yet, at least.
Let me ask you about the picture you tweeted out over the weekend, Hank Mustin, the DDG out in the Pacific, shadowing a Chinese carrier battle group. This is an image and a scene that was very common, not just throughout the Cold War, but in the decades since, with U.S. ships increasingly shadowing the Russians. Russians, obviously, historically have always shadowed us. Chinese have shadowed us in the Pacific for a long time. Now we're shadowing them. And yet, if you were the Navy, why wouldn't you want this picture out, right? You're keeping an eye on the guy as he's driving around, and you're doing what you should be doing. Why was this picture proven to be so controversial?
So this is a picture. So the Chinese aircraft carrier Liaoning is at the center of a very conventional task group right now, out in the South China Sea. Three destroyers, a frigate and a supply ship. That's what a carrier task group looks like, including their new type of 55 destroyer, very large destroyer, Nanchang. For that, this is the first mission it's been on. Very interesting. So we have this nice picture that came out, taken from behind two guys, the commanding officer and the XO, executive officer of the destroyer Mustin, on their bridge wing. The CO's got his feet up on the bulkhead, relaxing in his chair, watching about a mile away. Here's the aircraft carrier Liaoning. The caption doesn't mention the aircraft carrier, nothing, but the it's the Chinese tail our ships every single time we enter the South China Sea, which is an enormous area, and China wants to act like it's theirs. That's why it's called the China South China Sea, I've heard them say. So there is a Chinese tail on every one of our ships all the time. You know, come topside, look around, scan the horizon, there he is. We rarely release any imagery showing that, and it's always in the background, and we rarely point to it. Very rare. Even more rare are in actually, this may be the first time, that show pictures of us tailing them. This compares with the policy with Russia, where pictures of us tailing our NATO and allies ships, especially tailing Russian ships, particularly going through the English Channel, are legion. And both sides, Russia and the U.S., engage in a lot of imagery when they're overflying each other and all this stuff, particularly in the Black Sea. This is par for the course. We do not do this with China. It is there's a lot of disagreement inside the Navy, inside the Pentagon, inside the government, inside the White House, inside the State Department about whether this is a good idea or not. Some people think it's doing the Chinese work for them, you know, because the Chinese are saying it's our place and you shouldn't be here.
Right.
And that's some people look at it as us as putting imagery out does that. Other people say, yeah, but it's illegal and this is provocative and it's not theirs and it doesn't belong to them. And they're acting like it does. So you get both sides of this. And I think even on this side, this picture got through. I'm not sure it got through all the wickets it normally gets through in this case. And it just created a huge amount of interest when you pointed out, you know, what you're looking at.
I think it's a great picture. It's a great message. And the South China Morning Post wrote that the U.S. Navy was sending a message to China by shadowing the Chinese aircraft carrier. And I think it's a great message. You know, we're watching and we're paying attention. You know, two can play at this game. Very briefly, Cervello, want to get your sense on this, because wouldn't this be the exact kind of picture, if you're the United States Navy or the United States government, that you want to release at this moment?
You would think yes, Vago. And there's a lot that goes into the decision-making about what and how to release a photo like this. The problem is over the last several years, the decision-making about, you know, what to release and how to release digital products has been on the kitschy and ham-fisted side. So it's hard to tell if this is a change in messaging where the Indo-PACOM commander made a conscious decision to release the image and then the Navy is pushing it hard, or if this one just simply slipped past the goalie and the Navy's trying to make the most of it after the fact. I can't honestly tell you which it is, which I think is what Chris and others you know, were openly asking about is hey, or did we finally have our act together, or did this one simply slip by? I'm not sure which is more concerning, that it took us this long or that it may have just slipped by and we may go right back to pretending that the Chinese aren't out there with the Liaoning and other new and capital platforms. So we'll see what happens here in the near future.
Let me ask one last question. I mean, as we've been taping this, the news has broken that President Biden wants to withdraw all 4,500 U.S. troops now in Afghanistan by September 11, 2021, on the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attack, obviously, that precipitated the U.S. engagement in Afghanistan, although we did have special operators there before then, right? So, I mean, there was a presence in the country upon which we built when the balloon went up. Cervello, you know, your entire military career was, you know, involved Afghanistan to a degree. You were a 1999 graduate of the United States Naval Academy. So, you know, the vast preponderance, you know, you were a JG when we went into Afghanistan and obviously ended up escorting a lot of senior leaders there. Donald Trump suggested this and all hell broke loose. Is Joe Biden going to succeed in getting this through and doing it? Because a lot of people would look at that and say, it's an irresponsible decision. Let's keep some troops there to support our Afghan allies. And I have to say that for an administration that talks about the importance of allies and partners, we have sort of been hanging out our ally in Kabul out at a time when it looks like the Taliban is going to take over, and the parallels to South Vietnam are not overwrought at this point. Without U.S. support, it is unlikely the Kabul government is going to survive. Just like without our support, it was unlikely that the government in Saigon was going to survive.
There will clearly be repercussions for making this decision, both in the region and across the larger ally network. It will call into question, as you've talked about many times, it will call into question the reliability of the relationship with the United States. And, it will make people in the region, I think, make more selfish calculations as to how they're going to make decisions moving forward. That said, it has been two decades. My sense is that we've achieved all that we're going to achieve, and that the Biden team wants to make this decision early so that it's not theirs, that they, that they don't inherit this, that they can make a decision and move on, that this was the other guys, Trump, Obama, and Bush, it was their problem. And that if there is a time to make a decision, now is that time. So they make the decision. And I mean, in terms of Trump versus Biden, I mean, I just think there's so many different factors that go into the leadership team that's there now versus the leadership team that was there, just 3 or 4 months ago. And so if a team is going to get a pass, and if there's going to be trust, I think it's going to be with this administration. So I think it's a good decision time-wise, and I think time will tell if it's the right decision for Afghanistan, for the United States, and for the broader coalition that fought for the last two decades.
I can't agree. I think it's totally the wrong decision. Never announce a date. The Paris Peace Accords in 1973, where the U.S. agreed to pull out of Vietnam. It was almost exactly 2 years from that point to the fall of Vietnam. It'll be probably sooner than that for the government in Afghanistan to fall. Whereas a peacekeeping mission, even just a role-keeping mission that is right now being run largely by NATO, has a chance of stability in the region. My read on this is that you're right, everybody died in vain if you're just going to declare victory and pull out.
Guys, thanks very, very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Chris, always an honor and pleasure having you guys on. Look forward to having you back on again soon. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Vago.
Thanks, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.